From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley on white supremacist rallies.
Charlottesville, just like Donald Trump, are symptoms of something that has been going on in America since we refused to deal with the aftermath of slavery.
And the Michigan Trump Republicans say they've got the president's back.
Of course, his response is never enough. He's been called a racist. He's been called a Nazi. You know, I've been dealing with those types of accusations since campaigning for him.
How to achieve flow state when you're working, when you're totally immersed and lose track of time.
Our brain circuitry shifts a little bit. We let off on the brake, maybe a little bit more on the gas, and things just seem to go in that effortless flow.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it has happened. The Great American Total Solar Eclipse. The first time in 99 years that a solar eclipse stretched from the Pacific to the Atlantic coast. And yes, we've all been anxiously anticipating the event. So now that Eclipse Day has come and gone, let's get some reaction from eclipse gazers in Ann Arbor.
We're using cereal boxes and crackers to capture the eclipse. We've also got a cardboard box, which is the size of a small child, which is working very well. And we have goggles, which are obviously the best viewing option.
It's pretty neat. It's just a lot of waiting around, waiting for the 82% coverage or whatever we're getting here. So
I think we're getting a bit closer, like 80 now. Yeah, it's at 80%.
I have another cracker if anyone wants to use a cracker.
So there's a bunch of pinholes inside the cracker, the same way a pinhole camera works. So you just hold it at the angle to the sun and you can see the little sun crescents there.
You see?
I didn't bother to buy any glasses, so I borrowed a colleague's shoebox. It shows a blurry little blob of light.
Yeah.
I think I watched the wrong YouTube video.
There was no light pollution.
Kind of cool, yeah.
It's cooler to look through the cracker or the glasses or the Cheerios box.
Yeah.
Nice to see people looking up and not down twiddling with smartphones. If you did not get to watch this awe-inspiring natural phenomena, fear not. The next time a total solar eclipse will be visible here in this country will be 2024, so get your safety glasses now. We have just had back-to-back weekends where white supremacist groups staged marches. First, Charlottesville, Virginia, where counter-protester Heather Heyer was killed by a weaponized car. The driver was 20-year-old James Alex Fields of Maumee, Ohio. He faces 10 felony charges, and police say more charges could be on the way. Last Saturday in Boston, a small right-wing free speech rally was dwarfed by tens of thousands of counter-protesters. The few dozen right-wingers called it quits and were escorted away from Boston Common by police, even as the city's mayor urged counter-protesters not to confront members of hate groups. And as we know, after Charlottesville, President Trump declared there was blame on many sides and then later doubled down on that, declaring there were fine people on both sides. Let's talk about all of this now as we welcome Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. Good to see you, Rochelle.
Thank you very much.
Where is American history standing right now, do you think?
We are on the precipice of something either really, really great or really, really bad. I think that, as I said in my column, this is the point in history, and we've had several points in the past, where we have to choose what America is going to be. And if people stand up the way you see them doing in Charlottesville and in Boston and soon apparently in Baltimore, then you will be able to look back and say this was one of those points where Americans didn't let people who don't believe in the America that we fought all these hundreds of years to create, this is when they decided to fight and keep it. Or we can have something really terrible to happen and, you know, racists will take America back, using a motto from the president who may or may not have meant it that way.
But it has morphed to that. If he didn't mean it that way,
then he should say that, and he should say it right now for all of you racists. When I said we want to take our country back, I meant take America back for everybody of every color to a time when government wasn't so big and we didn't have such corruption and the banks didn't run everything, if that's what he meant. But if he meant what many of us think he meant, then what's happening is exactly what he wanted to happen, which is why after he decried the racists and terrorists who attacked in Charlottesville, and they obviously called him up and said, "What's wrong with you? What you talking about, Willis? you need to get out there and make sure you're on our side. And then he goes, there was blame on many sides. I think he's making very clear who and what he is.
As you wrote in your column, we should not be surprised by Charlottesville. Why is that?
Charlottesville, just like Donald Trump, are symptoms of something that has been going on in America since we refused to deal with the aftermath of slavery. I don't know why people keep being surprised by this. I don't know why they think this is going to stop until we deal with it. We had one of the most horrific episodes in the history of the world to happen here. And when slavery ended, there was no effort to make sure that we did something to solve problems, to heal wounds, to make sure that people who weren't treated as second-class citizens but weren't treated as citizens had the same right to pursue life, liberty, and happiness as everyone else. And we've spent more than 150 years pretending like that's okay. And it's not. And until we deal with it, we're going to continue to have these clashes. We're going to continue to have people who want those days back again to try and get those days back again. And by God, that's not going to happen on our watch.
And how do you answer people? I've seen a lot of it on Twitter, especially after Charlottesville, saying we're better than this.
I appreciate that they say that. But if they're not doing something to make us better than this, it's empty words. As much as I am heartbroken by Heather Heyer's death, she went out and did something. You don't have to stand in front of a tank. You don't have to stand in front of a Nazi with a pole or a baseball bat. But there are things that you can do. The time for just talking about it or just believing in it or just saying we support it are over. You have to do something. I get friends who call me up all the time saying, okay, tell me, give me something specific. I said, well, are you asking who to write a check to? Or are you asking what group to send letters on behalf of? What is it that you think you can do? Because everybody has to do what their talent is. Go and speak at churches. Go and talk to people. Go and explain that this is not the America that you want. Every protest doesn't have to be standing on a street corner. But the most important thing that people have to do right now is to make the GOP understand that you're responsible for a large part of this and we don't like it. That means you have to call your congressman every day. I mean, imagine congressmen, and it's mostly men who have done this, refusing to have town halls because they're afraid of their constituents who don't want to talk about what they've wrought. Make them talk about it. Make them see it. You can go stand in front of a congressman's office and so far not get hurt. Don't go and stand in a protest. Take about 100 of you and go to a congressman's office and sit in the way we used to do at the University of North Carolina before I was a journalist. And we said, you're not doing right by these things and we want to change. Get in where you fit in. Find where your talent can take you and do something.
Rochelle, there are voices in this national debate that has really been boiling on the front burner since Charlottesville. But as you say, it predates Charlottesville by a long time. But there are people saying, look, I do not support the KKK. I do not support Nazis. But I did not believe Hillary Clinton was the best choice, and I voted for Donald Trump. And we know Michigan was one of the three states that helped put him in the White House. So there are people listening to us right now who believe that. How do you answer them, the ones that say, I don't support Nazis?
I didn't think Hillary Clinton was a good candidate. But as I said in my column, you can vote for someone who's going to start World War III, or you can vote for someone who won't start World War III, but may lie to you about what they did.
The voting is done. So they voted
for... So let's move past the election,
yep.
Because every time I write about what's going on now, they go, the election is over. Get over it. I'm over the election. We're talking about the president. We're talking about the person who literally can start global thermal nuclear war, which I never heard of before, War Games, the 1983 movie that scared the bejesus out of me because a kid could accidentally do something like that. And that's what we have. It's like a kid in a candy store who literally doesn't feel he is responsible to anyone. We need to stop talking about the election. We need to stop talking about the voting. We need to stop the president from campaigning and try to get him focused on healing America.
But can people continue to support Donald Trump as president and yet disavow white supremacist groups?
Well, they can do it, but they're deluding themselves. Anybody who has watched him this week and says, well, I support him even though I don't like that he did that. Nope. You like him, you support him, that means you have to support what he does. You can't separate something like that.
I've heard it said, people who support Trump and say, look, he is not an articulate guy, never has been. He doesn't speak in complete sentences. His thought stream is all over the place. And he fumbled the ball in an effort to point out that in Charlottesville, there were people among the counter-protesters who swung with flagpoles and who threw punches.
Here's the thing, and I very rarely say that Donald Trump is right. But on this small point, Donald Trump is right. But what he doesn't understand and what he missed a great moment to be able to do, which is what leaders do, they find those moments, and God, he missed it. Those Klansmen and Nazis and domestic terrorists weren't supposed to be where they were supposed to be. Now, this can't get down to it. They started it. kind of thing, but they did. If they had gone and had their protests over here and said, we hate Jews and we want our country back, and you go over there and do that, you've got the right to do that all day long. And I will fight as much as I can't stand you for the right for you to do that.
And the ACLU did
that. And the ACLU did that, because that's what freedom of speech means. But what you can't do is leave where you're supposed to be and come over and instigate a fight and then get mad and cry about it, because people then fight back. Donald Trump should have said, this was one of those situations where these people had the right to be there. They should have stayed where they were. And once they left their place, people on both sides were fighting. Then you've got a both sides thing. Then you've made a point that's right, so that in the future, you stay over here, you stay over here. Here's two protests. And that's great, because the problem is going to be when they continue to try to meet. And the guy, Christopher Cantwell, who until he got in trouble with his boss and the law, was talking about how more people will die and we are going to, you know, create more problems. And, you know, rhetoric matters.
This is a white supremacist. Those of us who watch the Vice News report from the embedded reporter that weekend in Charlottesville met Mr. Cantwell.
Yes.
These white supremacists like Cantwell have come out from behind their keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
Here they are marching down streets of American cities, hoods are off.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote a piece saying it's time to rip off the cloaks of anonymity from racists. How and why?
If you believe so strongly that America should be a separatist nation, that white people are better than black people just because of color, and that, you know, you want an America where white supremacy rules, then by God, stand up and say that. Lose your job, lose your family, lose your friends. If you really believe that, see, that's why the hoods are off. That's why people don't ride around on horses at night anymore. If that's what you truly believe, then stand up for it. But if you know that that is heinous and wrong, and you don't want people to know you feel that way, then maybe in your heart you're not quite behind that idea. So I think if somebody's going to stand out there and say Jews are horrible and blacks are inferior and we want a white America, I want their picture on the front page of every newspaper in the country. I want people to know who they are. I want them to stand up and say who they are.
And isn't it interesting that the descendants of Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and President Jefferson Davis have all said, take it down, take it down. The Robert E. Lee descendants said he never wanted glory. He
making America great again. That's what they're doing. America is too big and too important and too exciting and too special for us to allow a small group of people, misguided as they are, to take our country and tear it apart. And if the descendants of these men who were wrong and who know that that doesn't belong in our current America can say that, then how can anybody else not?
Rochelle Riley, Detroit Free Press columnist. Always great to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
And later in the hour, we'll hear from an organizer for the Michigan Trump Republicans holding a rally tonight in West Michigan to say they've got the president's back. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If they know what it is, most people despise gerrymandering, the practice of drawing legislative or congressional districts largely based on partisan advantage. It's hated unless your party is benefiting. Last year, a book came out. The title includes a word we can't say on the radio. It's called Rat Effed, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count. The author is David Daley. Stateside's Lester Graham spoke with him last year. But with the new paperback version out this year, Daley wrote an epilogue exploring the 2016 elections. So Lester invited him back, and here's their conversation.
So remind us, give us a brief overview about your chapter on gerrymandering in Michigan.
Michigan really is one of the most gerrymandered states in America. It is a state that has gone for the Democrats in the aggregate. If you add up all of the votes for state house elections and also for U.S. House elections, more people vote for Democratic candidates than Republican candidates. And yet, Republicans hold 9 of the 14 U.S. House seats in Congress, and none of them have turned this decade on these maps. Republicans also hold a 63-47 advantage in the state house. And that has stayed largely the same this entire decade. Republicans drew masterful lines after the 2010 elections, when they took control of the entire state, of the governor's office, the state house, and also the state senate. And by having complete control, they were able to draw exactly the lines they wanted without any Democrats in the room. And the technology and the information that mapmakers have at their disposal now is so much better than at any time in the past. You can draw unbeatable lines that last for an entire decade. And that's what has happened so far in Michigan.
The 2016 election, as you note in the epilogue, cracked the Democrats' blue wall of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Even though there are more Democrats in Michigan, as you mentioned, Trump won. They all went for Republican Donald Trump. So while Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, Donald Trump won the electoral vote. You make the argument that gerrymandering had an indirect impact on the results. In what way?
Well, I think in multiple ways. The first way I would say is that the first thing that these gerrymandered state legislatures do is usually go after voting rights. They pass new kinds of voter ID laws or voter suppression laws, and they try to dampen down the number of Democratic voters. We know from a study at the University of California, San Diego, that the effect is to dampen Democratic turnout by 7.7%, and it doubles the participation gap between whites and Latinos and whites and African Americans. There is a reason why of the 22 states that had new voter ID laws on the books for this last election, 21 of those 22 states were controlled by Republicans. It's simply not something that the Democrats have objectively looked to do. So Clinton wins the popular vote by 2.8 million votes, but it's only 80,000 votes in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin that tipped the Electoral College. It is pretty easy in an election that close to point to multiple factors that could have tipped the balance. But in a state like Wisconsin, we know that the voter ID law there had the impact of potentially keeping 200,000 Democratic voters from the polls. We know that in Michigan, where you do not have to show an ID to vote, there were poll workers who were telling people that they did have to, and not making it clear that if they did not have ID, they could also swear out an affidavit and vote. It was only a margin of 10,700 votes for Donald Trump in the state of Michigan. In an election that close, every vote really does matter. And when there is this kind of messing around with who has access and who is allowed to vote, it counts.
You write that beyond former FBI Director James Comey's revelation about an investigation of Clinton, beyond Clinton's emails, beyond Russian hacking, gerrymandering had the greatest impact. Do political analysts agree with you?
Boy, I think that there has been rising awareness of the fact that gerrymandering is deeply dangerous and toxic for a democracy. The conventional wisdom on this, though, is a little bit stuck. I mean, I think that a lot of people think that geography has mattered more than gerrymandering, that Democrats have simply clustered themselves in big cities and Republicans are more efficiently spread out across rural areas and the suburbs. I think that that is a misnomer. Something else is actually afoot here. I mean, in 2008 in Michigan, when Democrats got more votes for the state house, they were actually able to take control of the state house. The same thing happened in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. But when Democrats got more votes, they took control of the chambers. In 2012, when Democrats get more votes in these states, Republicans maintain control of the chambers, sometimes with veto-proof supermajorities in states like Ohio and North Carolina. So to be able to say that this is geography and to suggest that it's self-clustering, it means that an awful lot of Democratic voters would have had to have picked up and moved between 2008 and 2012. I don't think that's what happened. Sometimes the easiest solution is actually the true one. What changed in between there? The district lines changed, and they changed so surgically. I went out and I drove every turn of Michigan's 14th, which is a district that starts in the south in some of the poorest neighborhoods of Detroit, and it kind of surgically winds its way through a lot of other kind of poor neighborhoods. It then cuts east along 8 Mile Road and then reaches up with a really long arm up to Pontiac with the goal of grouping together as many African Americans as they can in one seat. So Brenda Lawrence takes that seat with well over 80% of the vote, and all of those surrounding districts go Republican. This is how you can have 240,000 more votes for a Democratic U.S. House candidates in 2012, but a 9-5 Republican delegation. You pack all the Democrats in as closely as you can. You take all the other seats for yourself. But when you're on the ground and you're going turn by turn, you really see the impact of this. It's not geography. It's really careful map making. You can take three turns in the 14th district, come in and out of the district three different times, and watch the housing values decline from over $500,000 down to $8,500. The map makers knew all of this.
In this new epilogue, you mentioned you spoke to former member of Congress and former gubernatorial candidate in Michigan, Mark Schauer, about this issue of gerrymandering and how it affects Democrats. How'd that conversation go?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Schauer understands this very well because he was gerrymandered out of his seat in Congress and was a victim of this. And he has become very active on Democratic efforts to try and undo the gerrymander ahead of 2020. He had been a consultant on the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, which is the Obama holder project to try and reverse the Democratic bleeding in state legislatures, as well as on something called Advantage 2020, which was designed to be kind of like a version of the Republican red map strategy to take over state legislatures that was so effectively executed back in 2010. I've got a lot of respect for Mark. I mean, I think that the Democrats really fell asleep at the switch in 2010, and they did not understand what was happening.
I wonder, do they have a strategy now?
I'm not completely convinced that they do. I think that Mark has been an aggressive advocate of trying to wake the party up about this, but I am not completely convinced that the party has a winning strategy or that they have much of a strategy right now at all. Democrats face huge deficits in all of these state legislatures. I mean, it's not just 63-47 in Michigan, it's 66-33 in Ohio, it's 65-34 in Wisconsin, 74-45 in North Carolina. And if Democrats want to have a seat at the table when new districts are drawn after 2020, they have to win these state legislatures back. They have to really rebuild the party in places where it has atrophied and been completely hollowed out. And I don't see those efforts underway right now. What I see instead is $30 million essentially being lit on fire in John Ossoff's losing campaign in Georgia's 6th. Democrats spent a lot of money and invested a lot of resources in trying to flip a red congressional seat that they would only hold for 18 months, and that holds, you know, zero power over a redistricting. If Democrats can't find a way to get a seat at the table in redistricting after 2020, they will not have another shot at these maps until 2031. That is how consequential districting and gerrymandering is. If I were the Democrats, I would be focused on governor's races in these key states: Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida, five of the most gerrymandered states in the country, five states where Democrats stand little chance of making enough headway to take back a legislative chamber before 2020, but five states where if you win the governor's office, one statewide election that you can't gerrymander, Democrats would have a seat at the table and they'd be able to push towards fairer votes. That's where my resources and attention would be going right now.
Let's talk about another factor. The courts have stepped in and required a couple of gerrymandered states to redraw the lines. The U.S. Supreme Court could weigh in eventually. What's the likelihood the courts will decide the issue once and for all?
Well, the courts have never been willing to establish a standard on partisan gerrymandering. That could change. The Supreme Court will be hearing a case from Wisconsin that's called Gill versus Whitford, and that will be among the very first cases that the court hears in October. This is a case that was filed by citizens in Wisconsin who were very frustrated that even when Democrats got more votes than Republicans in their assembly races in Wisconsin in 2012, Republicans still got 60 of the 99 seats. That's now 65 of 99 seats later in the decade. And over the course of these lawsuits, the entire process by which these districts were drawn came out. Essentially, Republicans moved the entire redistricting and map-making process across the street from the Capitol into a private and politically connected law office. They then attempted to claim attorney-client privilege for the maps that they were drawing. They went through multiple drafts of these maps using painstaking algorithms based on partisan voting patterns. They called in professors and tried to come up with algorithms and talking points that would make it look as if this was designed to help give Latinos in Milwaukee and Madison actually a say in the votes. But all of this was a sham, as the emails and all the papers that got found on the hard drives proved, even though Republicans then tried to destroy those hard drives. It is a wild, wild story. But the courts have never been willing to say when a partisan gerrymander is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has been very consistent on this. It said that redistricting is part of the political thicket. It is inherently a political activity. They've yet to be able to determine a clear and manageable standard for when a gerrymander goes too far. Justice Kennedy has been very interested in this topic, however. He essentially asked for this case. There is a really interesting standard called the efficiency gap, which is a complicated piece of math, but really what it does is measure when a gerrymander goes too far. And it would essentially establish a bright red line that lawmakers could not cross when drawing maps. It is still a 4-4 court. Justice Kennedy remains the swing vote. And in many ways, this all comes down to him. If this standard appears clear and manageable to him, we may finally have a judicial remedy. If it does not, Kennedy will probably step down after this term. We know that simply looking at actuarial tables, the liberal justices on the court probably will be replaced by Donald Trump in this first term. This may be the last chance for a ruling on partisan gerrymandering this generation.
In some states, there are efforts to find more objective ways to draw legislative and congressional districts, including a proposal in Michigan. What do you think might happen with those efforts?
I think that those efforts are proof that citizens do not like this and that they are beginning to rise. Whenever these efforts go on the ballot, they tend to win. Ohio, Florida, Arizona, California, red states, blue states, purple states. People want their elections to be fair. And you are now seeing in Michigan and Pennsylvania and North Carolina a real renewal of efforts to be sure that our elections are fair, that our votes matter, and that politicians do not have the power to choose their own voters. The effect of gerrymandering, especially in this technological era, is that politicians are able to draw themselves seats that are safe for the next decade. We do not give legislators 10-year terms. We give them 2-year terms because legislators are supposed to be a perfect mirror of the people in John Adams's famous terms. These houses are designed to be the closest manifestation of a democracy, of our voices. And when these district lines get twisted and perverted beyond recognition, it makes our democracy more extreme. It makes it only responsive to the base. It means that the only elections that matter are party primaries. You've seen this in Michigan, where all kinds of candidates have gotten reelected out of these districts, even when there have been sexual harassment claims going on, even when they tweet, positive statements about the Klan. It is really, really hard to defeat a member in any of these districts, and citizens are beginning to take this into their own hands. It's an incredibly positive development.
You quoted a former Missouri Secretary of State as saying gerrymandering is the biggest problem in our country that no one's talking about. At least with voting rights, we are talking about it. And then he calls it gerrymandering, an active plan to undermine American democracy. Is that hyperbole?
No, it's not. If Democrats get more votes for the U.S. House in 2018, as they did in 2012, but do not take control of the chamber, you would have the White House, the U.S. Senate, and the U.S. House all under control of the party that got fewer votes. You would also have 69 of 99 state legislative chambers under the control of the Republican Party, even in states where they often get fewer votes. This gerrymander was an aggressive attack on our democracy. It worked so well because people think that gerrymandering is boring. It put them to sleep in civics class in eighth grade. It sounds like math. It sounds technical. So politicians count on that. And they've been able to get away with working the system like this because we're not paying attention. It's been incredibly effective. It's got to stop.
David Daly is the former editor-in-chief of Salon and the author of the book Rat F asterisk asterisk KED, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count. It just came out in paperback. It was good to talk to you again. Thanks for taking the time.
We appreciate it. Thank you, Lester.
And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focusing on or issues that you want to hear more about? Just let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Still to come, a state of mind that can help propel innovation and creativity. Our newest contributor, The Next Idea, says you just got to go with the flow.
Athletes call it being in the zone. Mm-hmm. Musicians might call it being in the pocket. When it's just that interplay with your comrades or your fellow musicians, your fellow athletes, you don't have to think. It's just working.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Part of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
Is there a state of mind that boosts innovation, boosts creativity? That moment of grace when you're immersed in something and everything seems pretty much effortless? Our brain guy says the answer is absolutely yes. Dr. David Fessel is a professor of radiology at the University of Michigan Medical School, where he heads up the leadership curriculum for the med students. Here now to talk about the flow state. Welcome back to The Next Idea. It's been too long.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So what is the flow state?
The flow state, I think we all know it sort of intuitively. That state where we're totally immersed in something that we really enjoy, whether it's running or gardening or writing or dancing, and we just are totally immersed. We lose track of time. Things just seem to work effortlessly. They just flow, just works.
And what's going on in the brain when that's happening?
Yes, yes. This emerging brain science is so interesting because we're learning more and more about what's happening actually in the brain circuitry when this is going on. And it seems to be there's some sort of brakes and gas pedals, if you will, in the brain. And when we're in that flow state, we sort of let off the gas pedal and maybe push down on the brake. And how does that happen? A lot of it has to do with this feeling of psychological safety. Do we feel safe in this environment? Is it with a certain group of people? Is it with a certain setting? Is it with music that we're familiar with? Is it with the movement, as in dance or yoga? So that is a really big part of it. And when that happens, we sort of give ourselves permission, if you will. Our brain circuitry shifts a little bit. We let off on the brake, maybe a little bit more on the gas, and things just seem to go in that effortless flow.
It strikes me as you're describing this, I'm thinking of great artists in terms of actors or musicians and when there are dancers. So when they're out in that moment, and maybe there's nerves beforehand.
Right.
But then you step on that stage, and a young friend of ours was actually a lead dancer in Lord of the Dance. She danced along Michael Flatley and toured the world. And the first time she danced lead, I remember Brea's comment was, it felt like I was supposed to be there.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. Athletes call it being in the zone. Mm-hmm. Musicians might call it being in the pocket. When it's just that interplay with your comrades or your fellow musicians, your fellow athletes, you don't have to think. It's just working.
But that's all fun stuff. Can that be applied in the workplace or in academia for students? Can you find yourself doing that even if you are working on a project for the boss or a paper for your teacher?
I think so. We probably all have it at moments as well. You know, you can think about the last time when you were involved in a project, maybe writing something or planning something or strategizing, and you looked up and it's, 2 hours, 3 hours later. I think it happens in those moments. And we can also help it by taking little breaks where we have those flow states. About a year or two ago, I started juggling, just wanted to learn it, and it kind of helps the brain circuitry, they say, as well. And so now when I want a break, I have these little juggle balls in my office and just take a 1 or 2 minute break.
So, and your brain responds to that in what way?
Yes, I think it's sort of like a reset. You know, you hit the reboot on your computer, and the circuitry sort of reboots, and you get a moment or two of that flow, and then your brain says, okay, I can do this more. And you go.
So can we bring that flow from the places where it happens naturally to perhaps that we don't find so pleasurable? Can we turn it on?
Yes, I think so. I think it has to do a lot with noticing first where it does happen increasing your awareness and your attention? If it happens in gardening or running or these other places, what elements, what helps it? Is it the music that you listen to when you're running? Is it the outdoor part of it? Maybe you can shift some of your activities into the outdoors. That noticing, bringing attention and awareness to when it happens, and then taking some of those elements and putting them in other places.
Interesting. So you have to be aware and realize you're in it, and then just find what it is that...
Notice the patterns.
The patterns.
The elements and the patterns.
If there is such a thing, is there a dark side to the flow?
There can be too much of a good thing. You know, some people say they get in this flow state when they're gambling or they're doing other activities, or maybe in the flow state in your work and it's 10 o'clock at night and you realize you're supposed to be home for dinner, supposed to pick up the kids. So you can have too much of a good thing. Have to keep an eye on it. I think most of us with our hectic, busy lives, though, having a little bit more flow in a healthy way, of course, can be a really nice thing.
Your essay talks explores the idea of trying to help others around us find their flow state. So how can we help others achieve that state, whether you are a supervisor or you're a coworker or a parent with a youngster? How can we help others?
Yes. I love that question. And again, I think it comes back to another simple question. Asking people, hey, what helps you be in that state? What helps you flow? Is it a closed door? Can we give you some time when we don't interrupt you, leave you alone in that way? Can we give you a certain kind of break where you need to go for 15 minutes around the block? And we understand that because that helps you flow. Asking people, what helps you flow and how can we support you in that way? And that gives them permission. And also, if you're doing it for yourself, if you're giving yourself that permission, I think you'll see and you realize the benefits and you want to naturally give that to other people.
Can our ability to find our flow state and tap into that, can that boost innovation, maybe even make a difference in the economy?
Yes. I think much of our creativity and innovation comes from these flow states where we just lose track of what's going on. We tap into our deepest creativity. We connect the dots. You know, Steve Jobs says creativity is just about connection. If you're in that flow state, you're totally relaxed, and you can connect those dots, and you can be more creative. And like you just said a minute ago, you can help others do the same.
Dr. David Fessel, his University of Michigan School of Medicine, professor of radiology, also heads up the leadership curriculum at the med school. And you can check out his essay and read all about the flow state by going to the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Thank you so much, doctor.
My pleasure. Thank you, Cindy.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
The Michigan Trump Republicans are rallying tonight in the West Michigan town of Hesperia, with more rallies planned around the state in coming months. Here with us now from the Michigan Trump Republicans is rally organizer Michonne Maddock, who is a co-chair of the Trump campaign in Oakland County. I want to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Michonne, I was looking at the website for the Michigan Trump Republicans, and there was a statement that jumped out at me, and I will read it. Every day, Trump supporters wonder, how can it get worse? And it's kind of interesting because I think there are a lot of Americans who do not support this president who ask themselves the very same question. So why are you and Trump supporters, you know, asking this question?
Well, as a Trump supporter, I can tell you that I certainly feel under attack myself. This isn't about me at all or any of the fellow supporters that I'm working with. It's about our president, that we worked really hard to get elected. And since the election, you would think that we would be able to relax or sit back and take a breather and watch what President Trump is going to do to transform America and what we believe will make America great again. Instead, it's been a nonstop barrage of attacks. And I think in that statement that you read, it's really just, you know, every single day, no matter what is happening in our country, everything we feel is being laid at the feet of President Trump. And it's just an ongoing attempt to try to stop his agenda. And that's coming from both the left and, unfortunately, some people within our own party.
Let's roll up to what happened two weekends ago in Charlottesville. What did you think about the president's responses to what happened there?
Well, I know it makes people angry, but his initial response was perfectly acceptable to me. I think it's ridiculous that we have to dumb it down, that he had to come out and specifically renounce the KKK and neo-Nazis. I mean, that's just a given. These are evil organizations, which is what he said. Anybody that would get into a car and drive into a group of people, I don't care what group they're representing, those are murderous, evil people. And that's exactly what he called them. And Of course, his response is never enough. He's been called a racist. He's been called a Nazi. You know, I've been dealing with those types of accusations since campaigning for him, so it's certainly not new. But that's why Michigan Trump Republicans has organized. It's why we feel like we must be on the front lines with him, not on the sidelines. He needs candidates and political backers that don't second-guess him or check political wins before they speak publicly.
But, Michonne, can you understand why there were Americans who were critical of the president's response? Because initially he did not call out these hate groups by name. And to many people, it appeared he equivocated and said there were, you know, blame on many sides, and then said many fine people on both sides. And that initial statement did not call those groups out by name. Can you understand why people were bothered by that?
I can't, personally. I know that there are people who will make excuses, but part of the reason I can't is that I live day to day under scrutiny and under attack for supporting our president. It's what I do. It's not what I do for a living by any mean. I own a business with my husband, and I'm just an activist. I was a national delegate for Trump. I was a county co-chair for the Michigan Trump campaign. So I've spent over a year fighting for Trump's agenda and fighting to get him elected. And I've watched him suffer attacks. I've got to spend time with him personally and his wife during the last week of the campaign and all of his children. And I can tell you that these are hardworking, patriotic Americans. So it's, you know, I have to tell you, part of the reason it's easy for me to defend him as not being a racist is that's what people are calling me. And so it's really easy for me to see how easy it is to just label somebody and walk away from it. I mean, I don't have a racist cell in my body. And yet I have people on social media and by text, you know, calling me a KKK descendant and a racist. And so it's really easy for me now that I'm suffering that same persecution to see what it must be like for him.
In your message to supporters on the Michigan Trump Republican website, there's an encouragement to people who are checking in on the MTR website to demonstrate love to combat their hate. What does that kind of love look like, do you think?
I mean, I would just encourage people to come out and see our events. We welcome everybody. We've even had people that are angry with President Trump that show up at our events. I mean, we open in prayer. We talk about the positive things happening in our country, the jobs that are being created, the regulation that is being taken off of businesses' backs, about the wonderful things that our president is doing for veterans and for police officers. And, you know, it is a positive message. That is a message of love. In my opinion, you only see the name-calling and the hate and the anger from the other side, which is why it's just so incredible to me that they call the side of Republicans as the hate groups. I don't speak any words of hate towards anybody that goes against President Trump. Instead, I would just hope that they would just open their mind and try to see what he's doing and to give him a chance and to let his agenda go through so that we can really see true change in our country and our state.
I'm speaking with Michonne Maddock of the Michigan Trump Republicans. They're holding a rally tonight in the West Michigan town of Hesperia. And that statement that I referred to on the MTR website, Michonne, there's a lot of blame being cast at the radical left, at the mainstream media, even GOP legislators. What responsibility do you think President Trump and his supporters like you should take on why his approval rating is only about 36% in Michigan?
First of all, I don't believe that approval rating. I mean, I just saw a story. I shared it on my Facebook page that MSNBC just shared about how low the approval rating is for Trump in Ohio, Michigan, and one other state. I think it was Wisconsin. I think it's, I hate to tell you, I'm talking to the media, it's fake news. If you came to the rallies that we have organized, and part of the reason we did this is it's really to give these people a voice. We booked facilities that would hold 40 to 50 people. Well, we have had no less than 120 people at every event. Tonight, we are going to be in the middle of nowhere in Hesperia, Michigan. We have over 220 people confirmed for tonight in a room that really will be lucky to hold 175. The reason this is happening is that people overwhelmingly want to come out and show their support for President Trump. These are the people that worked hard across our state to elect him, and they're called the silent majority. And I believe the reason they are the silent majority is they're not in any of those polls. But remember, those were the same polls that said that there was no way Trump would win Michigan.
And we probably should just point out for purpose of accuracy, that was the Marist poll, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, those three states.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Michonne, you described the rally in terms of peace, of being welcome, anyone's welcome. One of the guest speakers you've invited is Dave Ajema, who's former state representative and Republican National Committee man, who was censured by National Republican Party leaders in 2015 for his social media post, including calling gay people filthy, questioning what Muslims have ever done for American society, reposting an essay from a white supremacist magazine about black people not being able to reason well. Why was it important for you to have him at tonight's event?
He is a strong voice on this side of the state, a very strong leader in conservative values. And like I said, our focus here is supporting people who support President Trump and his agenda. Dave Ajema represents that type of a Republican. And, although there may be some backlash from some people within the Republican Party, don't forget that's exactly one of our messages about protecting President Trump is not every Republican, unfortunately, is on board to support our president. That's why it's really important for us to vet out and find out who those people are.
What do you say to someone who is just a hardworking person who happens to be Jewish or black or from an immigrant family who doesn't feel that there's a place for them at the Trump table? How do you keep the Republican Party from just being an attractive option for white people only?
It's ridiculous. One of the candidates who's coming to speak tonight that you're not mentioning is Lena Epstein. I mean, first of all, she's a woman. So, you know, that defeats the whole narrative of Trump hates women. She's Jewish. Lena Epstein is a very vocalist leader who is running to defeat Debbie Stabenow, and she is a Jewish woman. So I would encourage all minorities to come out and hear a positive, loving message, and they are going to see that they are welcomed into this party. You know, we just held a rally in Howell, Michigan, and that is where I suffered the most personal attack for a Facebook Live video that I did. And I'll tell you what, they talked about the constant comments that I heard were that there was not enough color in the audience. And that, to me, that is a racist comment. That is somebody looking into our audience and looking to see color. And first of all, I don't feel like as an American who's not racist, I should have to look around a room and think to myself, is there enough color in this room? Is there enough Jewish person in this room or enough Asian person in this room? But I found myself doing that only because I was forced to. And you know what? It dawned on me. We had a Japanese man who was one of the organizers. We had a Hispanic woman who was one of the organizers of the event. We had more than enough racial diversity in the room. And Lena Epstein was there also, who is representing a Jewish community. So the truth is their narrative, it's a lie. It's not even true. It isn't. The Republican Party is not made up of white men. That's just the story that they like to pound over and over and over to the minions who follow them.
Thank you. We just want to let you know that we did not see on the Facebook page that Lena Epstein was going to be speaking tonight. We've actually had her on stateside.
Okay.
But thank you for letting us know that she will be there tonight as well. The rally in Hesperia, in the West Michigan town of Hesperia. Michonne Maddock, Michigan Trump Republicans. Thank you for speaking with us on stateside, Michonne.
I appreciate your call. Thank you so much.
We did reach out to Lena Epstein, who was the co-chair of the Trump campaign in Michigan, and offered a chance to talk, but she did not get back with us. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Jacob Meschke. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.